just think with me for a moment about the many political, geographical changes that we have seen in our lifetime. We've watched the collapse of the Soviet Union, now splintered into numerous independent countries. We saw the reunification of Germany as the Berlin Wall finally came down. South Africa has been liberated from white rule. In fact, all of Africa has been liberated from European rule. We watched as the British turned Hong Kong over to the Chinese. There have been numerous new governments and countries throughout the Middle East and Europe. In fact, it's hard to keep up with all the new countries that are being formed. And we've watched as the European Union was created. All of this has happened within our lifetime. You know, all countries go through the same cycle and they end in the same place, in fallen ruin. They begin with high hopes and dreams and they end with either falling to internal corruption or external oppression. And some wonder at what point we are here in the United States of America in this cycle. In the pondering of Benjamin Franklin, are we a rising sun or a setting sun? Perhaps there are signs that we are a setting sun, that we have reached our apex and are on our way down. Political humanism in our government, godless atheism and secular humanism being taught in secular higher educational institutions, moral laxity and malaise in society as a whole, lack of conviction and courage among our politicians. And then the redefining of what it means to be a family with the legalization of gay marriages. There is a quote that is attributed to Professor Alexander Tyler, who was a Scottish historian who lived over 200 years ago. And he wrote about the fall of the Athenian Republic. And he writes this. He says that a democracy cannot exist as a permanent form of government. It can only exist until voters discover that they can vote themselves money from the public treasury. From that moment on, the majority always vote for the candidate promising the most benefit from the public treasury, with the result that a democracy always collapses over loose fiscal policy, followed by dictatorship. The average age of the world's greatest civilizations has been 200 years. These nations have progressed through the following sequence: from bondage to spiritual faith, from spiritual faith to great courage to liberty, from liberty to abundance, from abundance to selfishness, from selfishness to complacency, from complacency to apathy, and from apathy to dependence, and from dependency back into bondage. Now, at what point in the sequence are we as a nation? We certainly have fiscal policy woes with a record deficit. But, you know, the fact that the United States is not mentioned or even alluded to in biblical prophecy leads many conservative scholars to conclude that this nation will not be a superpower in the end times. Either we will cease to be a nation or be so weakened as to have little or no impact in this world. My own view is that the nation will crumble when the rapture of the church takes place, when Jesus Christ returns for his true church, and when true believers are taken out of here, as depicted in 1 Thessalonians chapter 4, I believe that the moral conscience of this nation will be removed. The backbone of this nation will be gone, and the nation will crumble. Now, it could take place before then. Nobody knows for sure the future of our nation except to say that one day it will come to an end. One day, it will experience what other kingdoms have experienced, its demise, For whatever is made by man will crumble, will fall, and it cannot last. But while we may not know the future of the United States, how long we will continue as a nation, we do know that our God, the true and living God, has a plan for this world. He is in control. He is sovereign over all. He is the one who sets up kings and removes another. He is the one who establishes the boundaries of the nations of this world. History follows God's plan. History is the unveiling of God's plan. But God is not only the God of history, but he is also the God of mystery. For he knows the end from the beginning. For in his word he has chosen to reveal the mystery of his plan through the prophets. He chose to reveal to Daniel in Daniel chapter 9 his 490-year plan for the Jewish people. 490 years to accomplish his spiritual goals of preparing the Jewish people for the return of their Messiah, Jesus Christ, and for the establishment of his kingdom here on the earth. And we have seen that we are now in the intermission between the 483rd year of God's plan and the start of the last 7 years. But God not only has a plan for the Jewish people, which plays into the end time events, but God has a plan for the world. And he revealed his plan for world history from the time of Nebuchadnezzar, who was the king of Babylon, to the time of the second coming of Jesus Christ and the establishment of his kingdom here upon the earth, a period of time that Jesus calls the time of the Gentiles. For as he says in Luke 21, verse 24, Jerusalem will be trampled by the Gentiles until the times of the Gentiles are fulfilled. The times of the Gentiles. And God chose to reveal this mystery, his plan for world history, to Nebuchadnezzar in a dream. Rather, I guess really it was a nightmare. And he chose also to reveal to Daniel the interpretation of this mystery so that we might know the course of world history and what will be the dominant world power in the end times. And all of this is recorded in Daniel chapter 2. Now this morning I want to focus on four ideas. First of all, the crux of the mystery. That is, what is it in a nutshell? Secondly, the challenge to the mystery, and answer the question, is this dream history or was it prophecy? And thirdly, the course of the mystery. And here we're going to look at the dream and its interpretation, and we'll discover the four great Gentile world powers that will dominate the world history from the time of Nebuchadnezzar to the time of Christ. And then lastly, I want to just briefly touch on the climax of this mystery, and that is, how will the times of the Gentiles end? So let's consider, first of all, the crux of the mystery that God reveals to Nebuchadnezzar. What is it in a nutshell? Well, look at our text beginning at verse 24 of Daniel chapter 2. Daniel chapter 2, beginning at verse 24. It says, therefore, Daniel went to Arioch, whom the king had appointed to destroy the wise men of Babylon. He went and said thus to him, do not destroy the wise men of Babylon. Take me before the king, and I will tell the king the interpretation. Then Arioch quickly brought Daniel before the king and said thus to him, I have found a man of the captives of Judah who will make known to the king the interpretation. The king answered and said to Daniel, whose name was Belteshazzar, are you able to make known to me the dream which I had seen and its interpretation? Daniel answered in the presence of the king and said, the secret which the king has demanded, the wise men, the astrologers, the magicians, and the soothsayers cannot declare to the king. But there is a God in heaven who reveals secrets, and he has made known to King Nebuchadnezzar what will be in the latter days. Your dream and your visions of your head upon your bed were these. As for you, O king, thoughts came to your mind while on your bed about what would come to pass after this, and he who reveals secrets has made known to you what will be. But as for me, the secret has not been revealed to me because I have more wisdom than anyone else, but for our sakes, who make known the interpretation to the king, and that you may know the thoughts of your hearts. Now the crux of the matter is that God is making known to Nebuchadnezzar what will take place in the latter days. In the latter days, a phrase that marks a specific period of time in Scripture. It first appeared in Genesis 49, verse 1, where Jacob foretells the lot of the 12 tribes after the conquest of Canaan some 400 years later. There it's translated, the last days. In Deuteronomy 4, verse 30, it refers to the period of Israel's return to God after adversity, and Deuteronomy 31, 29, of the period of Israel's future rebellion. Isaiah 2, verse 2, it points forward to the establishment of the millennial kingdom. And Ezekiel 38, verse 16, to the future war that's going to take place between God and the restored Israel. In each case, it refers to something future, something prophetic, something beyond the present moment. And in our text this morning, the latter times refers to all the coming events subsequent to the lifetime of Nebuchadnezzar and includes the establishment of the fifth kingdom or the millennial age. And so the period of time refers to as the time of the Gentiles. God's going to reveal the future. What's going to happen between the time when Daniel was living until Jesus Christ returns to establish his kingdom here upon the earth? Now, there is secondly a challenge. And the challenge to the crux of the mystery, and that is, does God really know, and can he reveal what's going to happen in the future? In other words, is this history or is it prophecy? Is it history or is it prophecy? The challenge comes from liberal scholars who theorize that the book of Daniel was not written by a 6th century Jewish captive in Babylon, but rather by an anonymous writer in the 2nd century B.C., who leads us to believe that he is Daniel. This anonymous writer pens this book around 167 B.C., during the Maccabean period, to encourage the Jewish resistance during the persecution of the Jews by the Greek ruler Antiochus Epiphanes. And their main argument is that since the prophecies of Daniel 8 and Daniel 11 set forth such an accurate, detailed history of the Greek period, it must have been written by someone who was living during the time of Antiochus Epiphanes. Therefore, they would contend that what Daniel, or the pseudo-Daniel, is revealing is not prophecy, but rather he's recording history. He's simply giving a historical account of the kingdoms that came to power after Nebuchadnezzar instead of predicting beforehand what would take place. In other words, this is history and not prophecy. Now, how do we answer this challenge? How do we answer this challenge? Conservative scholars believe, and I would concur, that the book of Daniel was written in the 6th century B.C. by Daniel, who lived during these events. The author took part in many of the historical events that are recorded in the book and has first-person experience. He is repeatedly represented in the book as an individual who receives revelation from God. God has given him the ability to understand and interpret dreams and visions, and he is represented as receiving revelation from God. In chapter 4, he records a first-person account by Nebuchadnezzar. Daniel, who was serving in the royal court, would have had access to Nebuchadnezzar to record his very words. Daniel's familiarity with the individuals spoken of in the book, along with the historical events and customs mentioned, necessitate a 6th century date. The minute details of the book could hardly have been retained by oral tradition for over 400 years, as the critics would suggest. Besides, Jesus Christ himself believed that Daniel wrote the book of Daniel. So when Jesus says in Matthew 24, verse 15, "Therefore, when you see the abomination of desolation spoken of by Daniel the prophet," he is referring to the prophecies recorded in Daniel chapter 9 and chapter 11. So if Jesus attributes the book to Daniel, so do I. I believe the death blow, though, to the critics' view came when the Dead Sea Scrolls at Qumran were uncovered and found that among the manuscripts dating to the 2nd century BC were fragments of the book of Daniel, as well as references to the words that were written in the book of Daniel the prophet. The book of Daniel had to be written before 167 BC for it to end up in the Qumran collection along with the book of Isaiah and other of the prophets, and was accepted as sacred scripture by the Jews. But the real reason that some liberal scholars challenge the early date of Daniel and insist that the prophecy of Daniel is only history is because they reject predictive prophecy. They insist that Daniel could not have foreknown the details, but must have written them after the events transpired and cast them in the form of prophecy to give credence to his writing. But such a view denies the power of God to reveal what he has predetermined. It denies that the God of history is the God of mystery, and that he can reveal the future. But the power of God to reveal the future is what sets him apart from all the other gods as the true and living God. Isaiah 44 declares, "Thus says the Lord, the King of Israel and his Redeemer, the Lord of hosts, I am the first and I am the last. Besides me there is no God. And who can proclaim as I do? Then let him declare it, and set it in order for me, since I appointed the ancient people. And the things that are coming shall come, and let them show these to them. Do not fear, nor be afraid. Have I not told you from that time and declared it? You are my witnesses. Is there a God beside me? Indeed, there is no other rock. I know not one. Who then is like me?" God asks. "Who can foretell what is to come? Who can lay out the future like I can?" The truth is, no other God can. No other God knows the future except the true and the living God. In Isaiah 46, God challenges the people to compare him to the gods of the Babylonians, to Bel and the Nebo. And the fact is, there is no comparison. For the God of Israel says, "Remember the former things of old, for I am God and there is no other. I am God and there is none like me, declaring the end from the beginning, and from ancient times things that are not yet done, saying, my counsel shall stand, and I will do all my pleasure." God makes known the end from the beginning. We know how this world will come to an end. For God has revealed to us the end in his prophetic word. And the God of history, the God of mystery, has revealed to Nebuchadnezzar what will take place centuries to come. Now let's look briefly at the course of this mystery, the times of the Gentiles. And we're going to look at the dream beginning at verse 31. Follow along as I begin reading at verse 31. God said, Daniel says, "You, O king, were watching, and behold, a great image. This great image, whose splendor was excellent, stood before you, and its form was awesome. The image's head was of fine gold, its chest and its arms of silver, its belly and thighs of bronze, its legs of iron, its feet partly of iron and partly of clay. You watched while a stone was cut out without hands, which struck the image on its feet of iron and clay and broke them in pieces. Then the iron, the clay, the bronze, the silver, and the gold were crushed together and became like chaff from the summer threshing floors. The wind carried them away so that no trace of them was found. And the stone that struck the image became a great mountain and filled the whole earth." Now I want to make a few observations about this dream. First of all, it is a great image. It is huge. It's immense. It's not an idol, but rather a statue corresponding to human form. And what impressed Nebuchadnezzar was its size and its brilliance. It's described here as excellent, as dazzling, a real attention-getter, as being awesome. I want to notice, secondly, that the image is made of different metals. Namely, its head was of gold, its breast and arms were of silver, its abdomen was of bronze or brass, and the legs of iron, and the feet had part iron and part clay. Now, I want to note that the preciousness of the metal deteriorates from top to bottom. Gold certainly is more precious than silver and more precious than bronze and brass and even iron. Gold is the most precious of all metals that we have. Secondly, there is also a lower specific gravity from top to bottom. Gold with a specific gravity of 19 is much heavier than silver at 11, which in turn is heavier than brass at 8.5 and iron that is 7.8. In other words, this image is top heavy. It is top heavy and easily toppled. And thirdly, while the material decreases in weight, they do increase in hardness, with the exception of the feet of iron and clay. Now, thirdly, this image is unified only at the head. The rest of the body is divided. Fourthly, the image remains a unified whole until the very end, when it is completely destroyed by the rock that grows into a mountain. Now, what does all of this mean? What does all of this mean? What is the course of human history? Well, let's examine God's interpretation beginning at verse 36 of Daniel chapter 2. Follow along as I read. He says, "This is the dream. Now we will tell the interpretation of it before the king. You, O king, are the king of kings. For the God of heaven has given you a kingdom, power, strength, and glory, and wherever the children of men dwell, or the beasts of the fields, and the birds of heaven, he has given them into your hands and has made you ruler over all. You are the head of gold. But after you shall arise another kingdom, inferior to yours. Then a third kingdom of bronze, which shall rule over the earth. And the fourth kingdom shall be as strong as iron, inasmuch as iron breaks in pieces and shatters everything. And like iron that crushes, that kingdom will break in pieces and crush all others. Whereas you saw the feet and toes partly of potter's clay and partly of iron, the kingdom shall be divided. Yet the strength of the iron shall be in it, just as you saw the iron mixed with ceramic clay. And as the toes of the feet were partly of iron and partly of clay, so the kingdom shall be partly strong and partly fragile. As you saw iron mixed with ceramic clay, they will mingle with the seed of men, but they will not adhere to one another, just as iron does not mix with clay." Now, God reveals through Daniel that there's going to be four Gentile world kingdoms which will rule over the land and people of Israel. The first is the head of gold, or Nebuchadnezzar, and the Neo-Babylonian period of time. Nebuchadnezzar's father came to power by military conquest, but he comes to power through God, who sets up kings and deposes them. He's given the title King of Kings by the God of Heaven, for as the absolute monarch, he would rule over the whole world, including the animal kingdom. Monarchy, by the way, is the ideal form of government. One ruler who rules over all. Thus, he is the head of gold. Interesting, gold was plentiful in Babylonian, and it was used quite extensively in the building. And so Nebuchadnezzar, in chapter 3, he makes an idol out of gold and commands all to worship him. Now, the Neo-Babylonian Empire of Nebuchadnezzar lasted from 636 B.C. to 539 B.C., almost 100 years. The story of the fall of Babylon is recorded in Daniel chapter 5. Belshazzar, the last king, was weighed by God in the balance, and he was found wanting, and thus he was killed by the invading armies of the second kingdom, described as the chest and the arms of silver. And we're talking about the kingdom of the Medes and the Persians, the Medo-Persian Empire. It was a combination of the two, of Medo-Persia into one, and thus it was a divided kingdom. Darius the Mede, who may also have been known as Cyrus the Great of Persia, he marches into Jerusalem, he kills Belshazzar, and he sets up a vassal state in Israel. Daniel was appointed as one of the administrators of the new regime. The text here only gives us a very brief description of the Medo-Persian Empire. In a later vision that's recorded in Daniel chapter 8, God will reveal more about this second kingdom. But it's revealed here that this kingdom will be inferior to the first. Inferior to the first. It's not inferior as regards to size, because its territory is going to be much larger than the Babylonians. Neither is it inferior as to duration, because the Medo-Persian kingdom is going to last nearly 200 years, almost twice as long as the Babylonians. But it will be inferior in the way that it governs people. For the Medes and the Persians had this crazy rule that once a monarch made a decision, it could not be altered. It could not be revoked. It was the law of the Medes and Persians. The people lived under the rule of law, and that included the monarch. He could not change the laws that he made. Now, we today consider the rule of law as one of the strengths of our country. Nobody is to be above the law, and we have a system of checks and balances designed to make sure that no one person has absolute power. But from Nebuchadnezzar's viewpoint, the restrictions on the monarch's authority to annul a law once enacted was less desirable than his own unfettered power. He wielded absolute power. He made the laws, and thus a stronger form of government. Now, the empire of the Medes and Persians was conquered by the abdomen and thighs of brass and bronze, or the Grecian Empire, the Greeks. Alexander the Great conquered the Medo-Persian Empire between 334 and 330 BC, and he assumes authority over its people and territory. Alexander the Great expanded his territory from Bosnia to India. It was the largest territory in ancient times. And at the time of his death in 323 BC, the kingdom was split into four parts, ruled over his four former generals. Now it too was inferior to Babylon, even though it was to rule over the whole earth. It too was inferior because of the kind of government that it had adopted. For its political traditions were more republican, that is, a representative government. Now again, we consider a representative form of government as being the best kind in a fallen world, the strongest. But from the standpoint of getting things done, accomplished, and taking action, we know from experience that the wheels move slowly and taking action, that and sometimes that there is gridlock in Congress. Now, the Grecian kingdom lasted until 63 B.C., when they were conquered by the Fourth World Empire, the legs of iron and clay, the Roman Empire. Now, this empire at first was characterized by strength, as iron is stronger than bronze, silver, and gold. Rome would crush everybody in their path. Roman legions were known throughout the world for their ability to fight, to march in, overwhelm the opposition, utilizing the short sword, which became the famous mark of the Roman soldier. And eventually, the Roman army would dominate every known kingdom in the Western world. Rome not only had a desire to conquer, but also a desire to establish colonies, and then to defend those colonies by military might. This characteristic of Rome has continued throughout the history of the West. Western nations have been colonizing nations who have reached to the uttermost parts of the world. With the colonizing came the necessity for great military power to protect trade routes and colonies from being overwhelmed by others. Thus, Western nations became military might, protecting the colonies that they had established. Now, as the two legs would suggest, the Roman Empire would be divided into two parts. One division in the east, with Constantinople as its capital, and became the Byzantine Empire, which colonized towards the north into Russia and into the east into Afghanistan, Iran, and Iraq. And the other division was to the west, with Rome as its capital. It conquered the entire region of the Mediterranean and into the Western Europe. Even after the fall of Rome, it continued to dominate as the kingdoms of Europe, the monarchies of France, Germany, Spain, Great Britain, and Portugal. When Christopher Columbus discovered the New World, it was imported here. Every single nation of the Western Hemisphere was started by one of the nations of the original Roman Empire. And so, our Western world is Roman to the core, including the United States of America. We have a Senate, which is one of the fundamental institutions of our government, which is a copied directly from the Roman Senate. The very republican form of government is based upon the Republic of Rome. Our courts, our laws, our military all reflect the courts, laws, and military form of the Roman world. We even derive our national symbol from Rome. For the eagle was also the symbol of the Roman government. Europe today traces its roots to Roman heritage. When the Goths and the Huns swept down over the Alps and overran Italy and finally sacked the city of Rome, there emerged from this chaos what is called in history the Holy Roman Empire. The Church of Rome became the stabilizing influence through all this time, and the Pope emerges as a Roman ruler. It was still Roman, but it was now a religious empire. The seat of imperial Rome government was transferred first to France, then to Spain, and finally ended up in Germany. The German rulers were called Kaisers, which is simply the German spelling for Caesar. In the east, the city of Constantinople was toppled in 1453 by the northern tribes, and the seat of government ultimately was transferred to Russia. The rulers were called czars, which is the Russian spelling for Caesar. Thus, the Roman Caesars continued right up until modern times. So the whole of the Western world is but an extension of this mighty fourth kingdom revealed to Nebuchadnezzar and Daniel. It is stamped with the Roman image. From that day to this, it is still Roman, and only recently have we ceased to colonize. We are living today in this fourth period of the fourth world empire, a period of Western domination. A period of Western domination. Now note something strange, though, about the extension of this fourth empire. It's described in verse 42 of Daniel chapter 2. It says, "And as the toes of the feet were partly of iron and partly of clay, so the kingdom shall be partly strong and partly fragile. As you saw, iron mixed with ceramic clay, they will mingle with the seed of men, but they will not adhere to one another, just as iron does not mix with clay." There are going to be 10 toes, made partly of iron and partly of clay. So this last form of the fourth kingdom will be marked by some sort of federation rather than a single realm. Now next week, Lord willing, we will be looking at chapter 7 of Daniel, where God gives a second vision of the same plan for Gentile domination, and he goes into more detail regarding the 10 toes of Daniel 2. There they're going to be described as 10 horns. But the 10 horns, or the 10 toes, are either 10 nations, or 10 kings, or 10 leaders of the Western world that are going to emerge, and emerging from them will be the little horn, the final Antichrist, the Western ruler, leader that will one day make a covenant with Israel to provide peace and security, at which time God's time clock for the Jewish nation will begin to tick again, and that last 7 years will be fulfilled. Now, something of the strength and the character of this 10-nation or 10-king confederation that will exist at the end of the Roman age is seen in our text. First of all, it's going to be a mixture. It's going to be a mixture of iron and clay. And this mixture speaks of progressive weakness and deterioration. These two metals together form an alloy, which may be stronger than either of them individually. But iron and clay cannot mix. If iron and clay are poured together into a crucible, heated to a high temperature, poured into a mold, the iron and the clay will remain separate, and the clay will produce a weakness in the casting. But what will be the weakness? The weakness is described here is that the people will mingle with the seed of men, but they will not adhere to one another. You know, the United States today has been known as the melting pot of the world, for we are a nation of immigrants. Our ancestors came to America from all over the world, Asia, Europe, Africa, and once here, through education, they learned English, our language, and learned about our history, our culture, and they became Americans. We were melted together as one. And that has been the strength of our nation, that we are the United States of America. But you know, today there are forces at work to weaken our nation through what we're calling retaining our identity of country of origin. And so that today we're no longer Americans, but we are now hyphenated Americans. Asian Americans, European Americans, African Americans, Hispanic Americans. Native Americans, and so on. And there is a push for us today to become bilingual and to speak Spanish as well as English, further weakening the ties between us. Now, this 10-nation confederation or whatever form, the final form of this Roman Empire, the Western world is going to be weak because the people will insist on keeping their national identity and cultures, refusing to be melded together into one people. They're going to be iron and clay. And this final form will be in existence at the time when the statue comes tumbling down. And that is when Jesus Christ returns to establish his kingdom here on earth. For note quickly, very quickly, the climax. In Daniel chapter 2, beginning of verse 44. It says, "And in the days of these kings, the God of heaven will set up a kingdom which shall never be destroyed, and the kingdom shall not be left to other people. It shall break in pieces and consume all these kingdoms, and it shall stand forever. Inasmuch as you saw the stone was cut out of the mountain without hands, and that it broke in pieces the iron, bronze, clay, silver, and gold, that great God has made known to the king what will come to pass after this. This dream is certain, and interpretation is sure." Now we will look at this climax, the return of Jesus Christ, the rock that's going to smash and obliterate the kingdoms of this world in the future, after we consider what will transpire during the tribulation period. The kingdom of God will be planted here on earth. It's not going to be left to other people. It will never be destroyed. It will be forever and ever. But as we close, let's consider how close we are to the end. Right now, we are living in the time of Western domination. The West. The United States is considered to be the leader of the West, of the Western nations. And the West is going to continue to dominate the world until Jesus Christ returns to establish his kingdom here on the earth. Jesus said in Luke 21:24 that Jerusalem is, remember, it's going to be trampled by the Gentiles until the times of the Gentiles are fulfilled. Jerusalem will be under Gentile domination until the times are fulfilled. Now, the most remarkable thing has happened in our day. On June the 6th, 1967, the Jews recaptured Jerusalem. This is a remarkable event, for it would indicate, in the light of our Lord's word, that we're coming to the end of the times of the Gentiles. Now, we still have our hand upon it, and the Western world still has a great influence upon Jerusalem and what happens there. But the times are coming. The word times, by the way, does not emphasize duration, but rather seasons of times, of opportunities. Our year is divided into four seasons, and so the times of the Gentile, and the same thing, is divided into seasons, four seasons, and I believe we are in the last season. We do not know how long the season will last, but just think with me what we've seen again in our lifetime. The disintegration of the old Soviet Union, the alignment of Russia with Iran, and part of the eastern portions of the old Roman Empire. We've seen the reunification of Germany, the rise and now the decline of American influence in this world. But I think one of the most intriguing developments has been the formation of the European Union, the reuniting of the countries that formed the old Roman Empire into one loose confederation of nations. One currency, the euro, one constitution that, by the way, they're having trouble ratifying, and partly because they don't want to give up their independence, they don't want to give up their identity as a culture, they don't want to come together as one. But they have free trade among the members, and the European Union is becoming a world power. The dollar continues to weaken, the euro strengthens, It's interesting that the European Union began with a treaty. It began with a treaty that was signed in Rome. It's the Treaty of Rome. Now, some might object and say that there are more than 10 nations. In fact, there are 27 nations that now make up the European Union. But I do know that when Jesus returns, that in the final form, there's going to be some kind of 10 nations or 10, perhaps 10 leaders over the Western world. They're talking now about dividing up into 10 economic groups. So there might be 10 economic groups. Perhaps that's what we're seeing today, the forerunner of what's going to happen, which means we're living in the last days before the coming of the Lord. We're living in the last days. And I want to encourage all of us to be watching, to be waiting, to be working, to be witnessing, to be loving God, living for God as we see the day of Christ approaching. May this warn us to wake up, for the big falling rock marks his second coming, and he's coming for us before that will happen. And so we need to be ready for the coming of the Lord. One day Jesus is coming back. He's coming back for you and I. It could be today when we'll be in his presence. And God, then the nations of this world, it's all following God's script. He wrote it out ahead of time. For the God of history is also the God of mystery.